Well, what we're looking at is a painting completed by Edouard Manet in the last 2 years of his life, when he was already suffering from, rather badly suffering from, the effects of the disease that would kill him a year or two later, at the age of 51 in 1883. The condition, apparently, was the result of an untreated syphilis infection. One early owner of this painting was the composer Emmanuel Chabrier, who didn't have syphilis, as far as I know. But that's all I'm going to say about the biographical stuff. We'll look at the picture from now on. We might go wrong. I might go wildly wrong later on. But at least if we agree, start by agreeing on what's there, we'll start from the right place. So let's look at the painting and see what it is. It does what the title says it does. It depicts a bar at the music hall or the theatre. It's hard to find a precise English equivalent for what the Folies Bergère was. But that's what it is. In the foreground, there's a marble counter with various bottles arranged on it, together with a glass bowl containing oranges, or they look like mandarins, actually, or tangerines, and a glass with two flowers standing in water. Behind the counter, with her hands resting on the edge, stands a young woman wearing a grey skirt, a jacket whose colour I couldn't be sure of in the reproduction I was looking at, and I'm not even sure I can make it out now. It's either dark green or dark blue. A dark velvet jacket, which is fastened by a line of little flowery buttons, and it has a lacy collar. And her blonde hair is cut in a fringe and gathered at the back. She's got a large gold locket around her neck on a black ribbon, and she's wearing a gold bangle on her right wrist, and I think she's got a couple of earrings, two little pearl earrings too. Everything we see in front, in this foreground there, is painted in a style of dash and brilliance, with textures such as the velvet of her jacket and the waxy skin of the oranges and the crinkled gold foil on the champagne bottles, rendered beautifully. The reflections in the various glass surfaces are especially vivid and convincing. Now, behind the barmaid is a large mirror, the lower edge of whose golden frame we can see behind her right wrist, with the wrist with the bangle on it, just above the marble counter, running along the whole width of the painting, parallel to the counter and a parallel to the plane of the picture, and only apparently a few inches behind the barmaid. He hasn't got much room to move about in. Most of the picture plane, then, is occupied by what is reflected in the mirror, and here the puzzles begin. Because whereas it's possible to describe what's in front of the mirror, what's on our side, reasonably objectively, as I've just done, what's behind the mirror, or within it, is much less easy to pin down. Is it a mirror at all? In some ways it behaves like a mirror. In other ways, it doesn't. But let's assume that it is a mirror and look at what it reflects. So reading upwards from the gold frame, we can see the reflection of the marble counter, and we see the left-hand end of it in the mirror, which we don't see in front of it. We can see that the marble itself is an inch or so thick, and the corner is slightly rounded. On it there stands a group of bottles, including one that looks like the bottle of Bass on the counter in front with the red trademark triangle. A bottle of some reddish wine or liqueur, perhaps, and some bottles of champagne, which are mostly hidden behind the barmaid's arm. But the ones in the mirror are not where they ought to be. The red liqueur and the beer on the counter in front are level with each other, whereas in the mirror, the beer is much closer to us. On the right-hand side of the picture, behind the dish of mandarins, the gold frame of the mirror is visible again. But here, too, things begin to go awry, because the line of the frame on this side, on the right-hand side, is an inch or two lower than the one on the other side. And in fact, it's tilted downwards slightly, as you can see if you come along beside the picture and squint along it. If the barmaid weren't there, we could see that the two parts of the frame wouldn't quite join up. As a matter of fact, that part of the frame is tilted exactly as much from the horizontal as her head is tilted from the vertical. It's tilted slightly to one side. Above the line of the frame on the right-hand side, there's the back of a young woman who is usually described as the barmaid's reflection. Unlike the young woman who's facing us and standing upright, the one in the mirror seems to be leaning slightly forward, engaged in some transaction with the man in the top hat, most of whom is outside the picture altogether, and whose face is sketchily painted, very close to hers. I'll come back to her in a minute. Behind the reflection of the immediate foreground, with the bottles and the counter and so on, we see a reflection of the interior of the theatre, with spectators behind a gilded balcony front, chandeliers, glowing lights on the columns, those two reddish square columns at the back, what looks like a cloud of tobacco smoke between the barmaid's head and the reflection of her head, if you can see it in the background there, and high up in the top left-hand corner, a trapeze with the feet of the artiste at the far end of her swing, poised above the crowd in the balcony and about to swing back towards us. There are many puzzles here, but to make sense of the space, we need to know how the Folies Bergère was arranged. The auditorium was horseshoe-shaped, with a balcony running all the way around, supported on columns. At the back of the balcony was a promenade, which is where we seem to be standing now, looking at this picture, with bars like this one, this was one of many, spaced along it, and behind each of the bars was a large mirror to add to the light and the glitter and the sense of things going on. The spaces between the large columns at the back are apparently represent the mirrors on the far side. However, if we, the spectator, the owner of the point of view, are standing on a balcony like the one at the far side, then where is it? If we look at the reflection of the counter again, we can see nothing actually supporting it. It seems to be floating in midair above the crowd below, and so must we be too if we're standing in front of it. Certainly, if this side of the balcony has a front like the one the women in the background are leaning their elbows on, it's invisible. It should be there beyond the reflection of the counter, and so should the reflection of the spectators, of the backs of their heads, who must be sitting at this side like the ones across the way. And then there's the reflection of the barmaid. If the mirror is parallel with the plane of the picture surface, then her reflection, well, you'd expect it to be directly behind the real woman. And invisible to us, we wouldn't be able to see it. And yet, it's some way off to one side. And where on our side is the man whose face is so close to hers, and whose reflection we see on that side? Those two figures, the man and the reflected barmaid, are actually seen as they would be in a mirror if the mirror was swung away, with the left hand sort of going away from us and the right hand staying here. And then the reflections would swing round and we'd see them like that. But the slight tilt in the frame at the bottom of the right-hand side, which I mentioned before, implies that if it's swung at all, it's actually swung the other way. It's all very puzzling, if we take it literally, if we think of a painting as a window into a space, because the space doesn't seem to make sense. Now, a few days ago, I was in Liverpool, and I thought I'd go and look at the Walker Art Gallery, where I'd never been. And one of the paintings I saw there, one of their most popular exhibits, is probably much better known for its title than for the name of the artist who painted it. Who's heard of Frederick William Yeams? Not a hand goes up. Who's heard of "And When Did You Last See Your Father"? Yes, and people recognize that. It's a narrative painting showing a scene from the English Civil War, and it shows a little boy of about 6 years old being interrogated by Roundhead officers. The scene's taking place in the comfortable parlor of a large manor house, and the little boy is dressed in bright blue silk or satin, his golden hair neatly brushed. He must have suffered at school, that boy. His hands politely folded behind him as he stands on a little stool to give his evidence. And his mother and sisters are shown in the far corner, trembling and clutching their hands and hoping that the honest little chap won't betray his father. And the Roundheads, there are seven of them in the picture, all clearly characterized, all different from one another, are behaving strictly and efficiently, as you'd expect Roundheads to behave, but not brutally. Indeed, the sergeant seems to be comforting the little boy's older sister, who's weeping. It's effectively composed, as if an experienced stage director had blocked out the scene, so the meaning of the story would be visible right at the back of the stalls. And the handling of the paint is immaculate, and the draftsmanship is secure, and everything works, from the perspective of the room in which they're standing, to the shine on the sergeant's steel helmet, to the little boy's pale profile against the dark oak panelling. Now, I mention this painting because Yeams was only a year or two younger than Manet, and When Did You Last See Your Father was painted in 1878, only a year or two before Manet painted A Bar at the Folies Bergère. They were exact contemporaries, and their paintings embody two utterly different conceptions of art. They almost belong to two different worlds. I think the main difference between them goes right to the heart of what we call modernism in all the arts, not just in painting. It has to do with what the subject is, what they're about. The Yeams is, of course, about the figures, the individuals, the people in their historical, dramatic, probably fictional situation. It's a literal sort of painting, that one, in which depicts the space with a one-to-one, easy-to-read correspondence between the image and the actuality. So it's a literal painting, but it's also a very literary painting. It looks like the illustration to a historical novel. And that, I think, is how it was read and enjoyed by its first public and by the millions, probably, of people who've seen and enjoyed it since in reproduction. I remember there was a reproduction of it on the wall of my school. But here's a thought experiment. Let's imagine a full description, a much fuller one than I've just given you, of that Civil War scene in words. We haven't got time to do it now, but let's imagine it done. It would be perfectly possible, because there are no puzzles about mirrors and reflections and things in the wrong place. Everything is easily and immediately readable. Then let's imagine we give that description to another artist of equivalent skill in draftsmanship and composition and the handling of paint, one whose ability to convey character through expression was the equal of Yeams's, and let him or her paint a picture of the same scene on a canvas of the same size and shape. Well, it would be a different painting. But would it differ substantially in ways that are important to the way the picture works? I don't think so. Effectively, functionally, it would be the same picture. It would move a spectator in the same way. What there is in Yeams's painting that excites admiration for the skill or arouses compassion or empathy for the people in the picture would do just the same in that other one. Now imagine the same experiment carried out with the Manet. Well, would it be possible at all? We could describe what's in front of the mirror more or less unambiguously, as I began by doing, but as for what's beyond it, well, we've already seen how difficult that is. There are too many passages that are ambiguous. For example, what's that patch of lighter pigment under the marble counter in the reflection between the barmaid's arm with the bangle on it and the champagne bottle, that little triangular patch of lighter colour? Is it a leg for the counter to stand on, or is it something happening down on the lower level among the spectators? Now, it can't be that, because if we look closer, it actually seems to be in front of the marble in the mirror, not below it. It's an effect of the light on the glass. And then there's the appearance of the painted surface itself, which is so important a part of our experience of the picture as we stand in front of it, which comes over to a certain extent, but a limited extent, in reproduction. You have to come here, you have to stand in front of it, you have to see the way the paint is built up. You see the way it's scumbled in the handling of the flowers in the barmaid's corsage, in the great chandelier, and the massing of the spectators on the balcony. It's Manet's particular touch, his hand, his brush strokes, that matter in passages like these. I don't think we could describe this picture in words with anything like the clarity and accuracy with which we could describe "And when did you last see your father?" So the thought experiment that worked with the Yeams falls at the very first hurdle when it comes to the Manet. Long before we get to the difficulty of actually painting an equivalent picture by reading a description of this one, we couldn't even find the words to say exactly what's there and write the description. The important things about the Yeams can be put into words. The important things about the Manet cannot. That's why I can stand in front of this one and describe the other picture to you, and the important things about it come through, but I wouldn't be able to stand in the Walker Art Gallery and describe this one and have the important things come through. Yeams's picture is a window on a scene behind it, which is the subject, the things that the picture depicts. That's the important thing about the picture. The surface isn't really important, provided it does its job of representing without confusing or being ambiguous. In Manet's picture, the painted surface itself is as important as the subject. If Manet had wanted to paint a picture, well, he would certainly have been able to. And if he had, the things that puzzle us in the reflection, in the depiction of space, would all be solved and clear and readable. But he wasn't interested in windows. And this is the difference I mentioned before, the great chasm that divides modernism from what it was reacting against. The modernists in painting, which we can see so wonderfully in this gallery, from the Impressionists through Cézanne to Picasso and beyond, were interested not only in the things the painting depicted, they were interested in the very nature of depiction itself. Painting became self-conscious in their hands. The modernists in literature, James Joyce, Virginia Woolf, show narrative becoming self-conscious in the same way. So around about the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, it became no longer necessary to find a grand, noble, dramatic, historical, religious subject for your work of art or literature to be taken seriously. The thoughts passing through the mind of an ordinary man on an ordinary day in Dublin, or the mind of an ordinary woman on her way to buy flowers in London, or the way light flickers and divides in a mirror, or the way the sun glows as it spreads and glows as it sinks behind the smoke of a railway station. The substance of daily life, especially modern life with all its glitter and variety, was more than enough material for the new self-conscious consciousness to work on. A little later, Picasso's most profound and revolutionary explorations of the nature of seeing and representation were conducted on the most ordinary and everyday subjects: a pipe, a bottle, a newspaper on a table. And that's why the only thing in this painting that's anything like a story, the transaction on the right-hand side of the picture between the reflections of the man and the barmaid, is depicted so briskly and so swiftly, so easily. If Yeams or his colleagues among the Victorian narrative painters had depicted a bar at the Folies Bergère, you can bet that that transaction would have been at the very centre of their attention. That would have been the subject of the picture. And it would have been called something like temptation. And we'd be invited to wonder whether the barmaid was tempting the man to have a drink or whether he was tempting her to come away with him and lose whatever was left of her virtue. For Manet, though, it was no more important, no less important, no more important than the oranges. But I still haven't mentioned the greatest mystery of all, an enigma so profound that even if we solved the difficulty of how to describe the rest of the painting in words, we'd still have to throw up our hands in despair at the impossibility of doing this. And this is the question, this is the problem. What does her expression mean? What is she thinking about? How on earth do we describe that? It's the most unreadable expression I know in any painting. It's far more mysterious and enigmatic than that smirking Florentine we know as the Mona Lisa. At the heart of this scene of pleasure, of glittering light and the sensuous richness of a dozen different textures, with the promise of delicious things to eat and drink, with music, we can almost hear the band, and conversation and laughter and applause as the trapeze artist swings fearlessly across the auditorium, with a hint of sexual bargaining as well. The Folies Bergère was well known for that. At the very centre of this world of brilliant surfaces, at the very point to which our attention is led by the line of her arms and the buttons on her jacket, there is this pretty young face expressing that profound, inexplicable, what is it? Sadness? Regret? Unease? Alienation? Her face is flushed. It might be that she's simply warm under all those lights. It might be like the flush that suffuses the cheeks of a young child kept too long from her bed. She's by no means a child, but for all the corseted fullness of her figure, she does look young. She looks innocent. At the same time, we wouldn't be surprised to learn that the conversation in the mirror between her reflection and the man in the top hat concerns her availability for quite other purposes than pouring glasses of wine and selling oranges. But perhaps there's a clue in that. Which is the real girl? This one or the one in the mirror? The reflection is displaced. Is she displaced in another way as well? Made strange, made different. A Mr. Hyde to a Dr. Jekyll, which Stevenson wrote, incidentally, only a year or two after this picture was painted. Is she two people? One whose character is as shallow as that of the man in the hat, as shallow as everything else in the mirror, only as deep as the glass itself, no more truly there than anything else in all that glittering surface, because it's all surface. And the other, who is as complex and profound as the expression on her face, a look that defies all description. I said that "And When Did You Last See Your Father" could be the illustration to a novel, but a bar at the Folies Bergère is nothing like an illustration. It's more like a novel itself, compressed into a single image. Nothing shorter than a novel, anyway, would begin to plumb the depths of the character who seems to be standing patiently, thinking of something else, in a dream, abstracted, miles away. All those expressions that mean not there. The one in the mirror is not really there, and the one who is really there is not there either. She's somewhere else, thinking of her lover, or her debts, or her parents and the village she comes from who haven't heard from her for months, or her little sister who has consumption, or thinking of nothing. And of course, she can't think really, she's not real at all. She's a painted surface, just like the reflection that isn't a reflection. But these reflections on reality, and we can't get away from reflections when we talk about this picture, are right at the heart of modernism, that astonishing movement in all the arts that was fertilized by Baudelaire, germinated with the Impressionists, and grew throughout the latter part of the 19th century to burst into a brilliant and fertile flowering with Picasso and Braque, with Stravinsky, with Joyce. In Wallace Stevens's great poem about modernism, The Man with the Blue Guitar, he has the guitarist faced with the accusation that he does not play things as they are. The man replied, "Things as they are changed upon the blue guitar." And they said then, "But play, you must, a tune beyond us, yet ourselves, a tune upon the blue guitar of things exactly as they are." They wanted, "And when did you last see your father?" But what they got was a bar at the Folies Bergères, and Cézanne's Grandes Baigneuses, and Picasso's Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, and The Rite of Spring, and Ulysses, and The Wasteland, and jazz, and the cinema, and the whole great 20th century cornucopia of beauty and strangeness and truth, and a new kind of artistic consciousness, which was really a reworking of an old consciousness, and making explicit something that true artists of every period have always known, that the work of art is not only about the things it depicts, it's about itself as well. As Wallace Stevens says later in The Man with the Blue Guitar, poetry is the subject of the poem. From this the poem issues, and to this returns. This is how art is different from science. Science progresses. It proceeds by falsifying what came before, by providing better and truer explanations. Later science is better than earlier science. But in art, there is no progression. Later art is not better than earlier art. Revolutions in art, such as Impressionism and Cubism and the whole enterprise of modernism, are all, at bottom, attempts to get back to something that had been lost sight of. In 2000 BC, the tomb painters of ancient Egypt were interested not only in depicting everyday life, fowling in the marshes, hunting with a chariot, dancing, they were interested in making beautiful patterns on a flat surface. In the early 16th century, Leonardo da Vinci was concerned not only to paint a likeness of that woman I was so rude about a few minutes ago, he was concerned with the fascination of applying paint so as to suggest the way air casts a soft veil over the rocks in the distance. In the middle of the 17th century, Vermeer was deeply interested in representing the appearance of a young girl with a pearl earring and her mouth slightly open, and he was equally interested in the way he could represent her three-dimensionalness by painting the highlight in her left eye in a slightly different place from the one in her right. In the Qing dynasty, the Chinese artist who painted a branch of bamboo on a porcelain pot was trying not only to make it look as much like bamboo as he could, but also to dispose the line of the branch and the arrangement of the leaves across the curved surface in a way that would be beautiful even if it meant nothing. The marks in soft black crayon that Georges Seurat made on rough paper in 1884 look just like the figure of a woman that he intended them to, but we can also see the sensuous pleasure he took in the application of the pigment, the way the light seems to soften and gather around the edges where the pigment catches only the high parts of the paper and lets the tiny depressions remain white. The unknown, the immensely ancient geniuses who painted the bison, the horses, the lions on the cave walls of Lascaux and Chauvet, all of these colleagues, all of these fellow artists, every single one of them. These cave painters took the greatest of care to represent the animals accurately, but that wasn't their only motivation. We can also see a delight in the rhythmic arrangement of the figures, an awareness of the contours of the cave and how they could be used to add liveliness and movement to the shapes they outlined with ochre and carbon. Great art has always had this double character, and the greatest art is perhaps where we see the two things in perfect balance. That's the real difference between A Bar at the Folies Bergères and When Did You Last See Your Father? Yeams and all the other Victorian narrative painters were only interested in half of what there was to be interested about. Money was interested in all of it. A Bar at the Folies Bergères is about A Bar at the Folies Bergères. It's about the mystery of that unfathomable expression on this ordinary young woman's face. It's about those legs suspended at the very end of the acrobat swing. It's about champagne and oranges and tobacco smoke and chandeliers and fashionable dress. But it's also about seeing and about recording the way the light glistens on those oranges and the way things in a mirror are different from things in front of our eyes. It's about the sensation of sight and the mysteries of representation. It's about painting itself. Thank you.